Grab your walking shoes and clean out your ears. It's time for the Acoustic Pedestrian.
Everybody, you just listened to Sabaton. It is epic, and we'll find out why in a little while. Gotta tell you about this particular podcast. I am so excited. We are recording this below the surface of the Willamette River. Yes, you heard that right. About 15 feet below the surface of the Willamette River in Portland, we are aboard a submarine. Really and truly. This is the USS Blueback. She is moored at OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. Two reasons why I picked the Blueback. One is, what a cool place to record a podcast. And number two, it's where I met my guest for this session. John Lynch is here. He is an author and a submarine tour guide just like me. And we're going to talk about books and how you write them. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. So let's start right off and talk about your book project.
All right. I decided to write the first in a series. It's New Persia, Before the Storm. And this is a book set in the far future on a planet that orbits the star 70 Ophiuchi. This is the home of different human societies. One of them is New Persia, and it's based on a small colony of people of the Baha'i faith that traveled there about 1,000 years before the start of the book. They have formed a much larger settlement than they started with, and over the years They've had civilizations rise and fall because of their own actions and also because of the climate. Every so often, there is a giant climactic event called a seed storm, where the local life will spawn and its seeds will spread around the world and set fires because the seeds are pyrotechnic. So you get something like a sandstorm, except everything that it passes over catches on fire. So what this does is this sets human civilization back every time it happens. The current level of civilization is about the same as ours in the 1950s, but there's another seed storm coming. And to make matters worse, they're at war with a neighboring country called Azania, which started from a bunch of African settlers of mostly the Mormon religion. They're more advanced sociologically and technologically. They're more hip. They're more cool. Azanian music is the music everybody wants to listen to. And New Persia is the more old, stodgy, you know, bigger empire. They're more like, Russia. That's the setting. My characters include a soldier, a pilot, a socialite, and a woman who's running out of time to get married, but she doesn't want to get married, even though she doesn't admit that to herself at the beginning of the book.
And this is the first in a series, you said, right?
Yes. I'm writing book two right now.
Do you know how many there will be?
I've got three plotted.
Okay. Does that mean only three or three for now?
Three for now. Yeah. Though there's going to be a definite conclusion, because I believe in those.
Okay. So yeah. The universe will end somehow, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It should.
It should.
Yes.
I like that. So this is your first book that you've written. Is that right?
Well, it's actually the third. I've written two other books. Neither of them have been published. I wrote one when I was 17, and I wrote another one about 10 years ago.
And have those been submitted for publication anywhere?
The second one, yes. I started submitting it again. I cleaned it up in this latest batch of writing that I've been doing with the New Persia. It's called Endemic. That one is about a team of special forces. They don't work for the U.S. government. They work for a shadowy, covert organization that deals with strange and alien and paranormal threats to human society. And they go to the Congo to investigate an Ebola outbreak. It's a really dark book. My dad was dying of cancer while I was writing it. So when I look back on it, I go, why is this book so dark? I go, oh, it's because I was dealing with that. And that was kind of my way of dealing with it.
Do you feel that writing is therapeutic?
It can be. I don't really think I'm writing so much for me. In the sense, I like doing it, but where the stuff comes from and where ideas come from, a lot of times it doesn't seem like it's coming from me, you know, or it's coming from some part of me that I'm not always in contact with, if that makes sense.
It does. I feel that way a lot of times when my catchphrase is, I don't write music, I discover it.
Yeah.
It just sort of shows up someplace and you go, where did that come from? And I don't know, but let's see if I can do it again.
That's yeah.
The hard thing with music is you have to replicate it. If you write an idea down in a book or on a piece of paper, well, there it is, the way you wrote it.
Right.
I know that the process of writing is something you've worked really hard to achieve and allowed yourself to acquire some success. Tell us what you do to be a successful writer in the manner of, you know, you succeeded by creating a thing.
Yes, because that's very different from getting people to buy it, which
yes,
is its own process.
Yes, that's very true, yeah.
What I do is I treat it like a job. It isn't a hobby. It's not something that I do for my own well-being, although like having a job, it's really important to my self-esteem, I guess, that I'm doing something. But that's not the primary purpose. I treat it like a job, like I have goals that I have to meet. I have deadlines that I have to meet. I rented a desk so I could go and work away from home. Because at home, writing isn't taken as a job. As much as I would want to take it as a job at home, it's very hard to work at home. There's demands. I have a family. So I have a wife and three kids. So they've got their demands. And also in the back of my mind, it always feels like I should be doing something else. Like either I should be at work as a tour guide, or I should be doing the laundry, or maybe I need to mow the lawn. And it just totally feels like I'm playing hooky. And that's always in the back of my mind. Whereas if I go somewhere else and I sit down in a workspace where there's, you know, I'm in an office, then it's like I'm at work. I've even found when there's nobody at home and everybody's gone for some reason, like, you know, the wife and kids are gone on a vacation or something, I still can't work at home because it's so ingrained in me that I go to work. I've actually gotten in the car, left an empty house, gone to work to make my copy. Another part of treating it as a job is you're doing this in place of doing something else that would pay you. Okay, like it's completely possible that I could have, you know, another job besides, you know, being the submarine tourette. I could do it, but I'm doing this instead. So there's a financial cost to it. There's an opportunity cost. I'm hoping it will pay off, but I'm also have decided that I'm going to be a writer. Even if nobody buys my stuff, I'm going to do it because that's who I am, and that's who I've wanted to be since I was about 10.
Well, it's a hard thing to do because any creative endeavor, whether it's writing or whether it's music or whether it's dance or painting or sculpture, you name it, you have to do the thing because you want to do it. And then, as the late, great Michael Hedges said, if you're really lucky, people will like what you do. And then you get sort of the downside to that, which is if people like what you do, then you have to produce more of what people like, because now you suddenly have to do this thing to eat, and eating is kind of important. It is definitely fun to create art, but it is a lot of work, and there are sacrifices that we always hear about artists make, and then there are sacrifices that we don't talk about that artists make. Things like having to have commercial success and play into that. The things that you don't do, the jobs that you pass up, for example, in order to pursue your art, it isn't as cut and dried as people want to think it is. So we all make our various sacrifices.
Sounded good.
Yeah.
I was sitting on the edge of my seat here going, okay.
You have to know that you can't sit on the edge of the seats we're sitting in because seating on this submarine is extremely tight, as you might imagine, and you can find out for yourself. If you are visiting Portland and you want to come to the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, when the museum is open, the submarine is open for tours. You might just meet John or me, or maybe both of us. So take an opportunity and come down. Plug over, why Persia?
I have always been fascinated with non-Western cultures. And a lot of, and how they do things. It's just something I've always felt. And then this is a military adventure novel. The one thing that Western civilization has been good at throughout history is military conflict. So it was interesting to me that to have non-Western societies in conflict and how that would be different. And also, it's just I like doing research and doing something different. I mean, it'd be easy to do, okay, there's a bunch of Americans in space and they're just like us. It's not as interesting as having some real cultural differences.
Have you visited Persia or that part of the world at all?
I haven't.
Okay.
I can't afford it. I would if I could.
If your book sells, you're going to have to.
If my book sells, yeah, I'll have to go do
the Persian tour for sure.
Definitely. But Persia is an ancient civilization that goes back 5,000 or more years and all the way to the dawn of history. And the end of prehistory.
So there's a lot to draw on.
Yes.
You also mentioned cultures that are different, but religions that are different too. So you've got African Mormonism, which is kind of interesting, and you work with Baha'i faith. Is
yes.
that right?
Yeah. The Baha'is are... I wanted a small religion that wasn't Western, and there's some choices there, but I wanted it to be more of a universal faith because you can do something like this... You know, the Sikhs or different, or Mahayana Buddhism in Sri Lanka or something like that. But that's been done. And I just thought it would be interesting to do something that could be a universal faith, but just hasn't gotten there yet. I just got kind of fascinated with it and started reading about it and going, oh, this is perfect. This is exactly what I was looking for.
One of the things that ended you up here on the submarine is you were in the Navy, is that right?
Yes.
And what did you do?
I was a what's called a cryptologic technician collection, or CTR. That's the Navy rating. What I tell people is I spent a lot of time sitting around listening to the radio. They sit in windowless rooms with air conditioning set on high for the sake of the radio equipment. I was working on a tropical island for a while, Okinawa, and I would go to work wearing a coat. And you listen for other countries' radio signals. So I spent a lot of time listening to the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans.
So it sounds like you were a nerd in uniform.
Yes.
Windowless rooms and lots of equipment.
Yes. So that's what I did in the Navy. They didn't ever send me to a ship, and I never volunteered for submarines because it didn't occur to me. Oddly enough, I should have.
So you're saying if you could go back and do it over?
Oh, yeah.
You would volunteer for sub duty?
Oh, yeah. That's where the interesting work was.
As a little piece of military trivia, in the United States Navy, you have to volunteer for the submarine service. You cannot be assigned there. Come down to the Blueback and you'll find out some of the reasons why people want to sign up for submarine duty. They're less obvious than the reasons people don't want to sign up for submarine duty. All I'm going to say is think about ice cream. Speaking of the military history plays a big role in your book. It is an interest of yours, yes?
Yeah, it is. One of the things playing into it is, you know, what makes a successful military in terms of fighting and winning wars, not in terms of morality or what's good for people as a whole, but the narrow purpose of a military to fight and win wars. I actually present that the enemy of the characters, who are all new Persians, the enemy is the Azanians, and the Azanians are pretty much better at everything. And having to cope with that is very difficult.
You're not going to tell us how it comes out, though, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay, good. Please don't, because yeah. you need to read John's book when it's published. So this is out. You've submitted this for publication, right?
Yes.
And your Facebook friends get to see your more interesting rejection letters.
Yes. I keep track of my rejections. I grade them. Now, form rejections, I don't usually post. Unless they're particularly nice. But I'll get a rejection and I'll dissect the rejection letter for what it's saying. Like, I got a rejection that said, we reject it because your beginning is too slow and it takes too long to get started. And it really should be handled as a flashback later. And it was a rejection. So I took that as like, oh, great. This is wonderful. So I'll just take the beginning, make it a flashback, and resubmit it.
And?
And then they rejected it for reasons that it didn't fit their publication schedule, that they said.
Okay.
But the thing is they gave me feedback. They gave me something.
Right.
And most places don't. They just have a very nice platitude-filled letter that doesn't tell you a thing about why they rejected it or what was wrong with it.
So I want to get back to your work ethic a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because you talked about you have to treat this like a job, and I hesitate to agree, but I have to agree. I work at home, except when I'm on the submarine doing podcasts or on other locations. And you do. There's things you have to do. For me, I try to start a load of laundry and then go back to editing podcasts, for example. But if I'm writing music or I'm writing a story, I feel I need that sort of continuous focus. So do you build time into your schedule for going to work at your shared workspace? So you have a regular weekly schedule kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. I do. This is kind of tough to talk about. One of the things you have to do is, like a real job, you have to prioritize it. Not only is there a financial cost, but you have to spend, some time by yourself, which means you're taking time away from the people closest to you. So I'm basically deliberately taking time away, that I could otherwise spend with, my family or doing things for my family.
Do you feel guilty about that?
It's kind of, you have to be a little bit egotistical to be a writer in that you have to be I'm writing these words down on paper and this is important enough to not be doing something else. But you're not getting, particularly when you're just starting, nobody's reading it but you and maybe a few close friends. No one knows that you're doing it, and yet this is important enough to be setting huge amounts of time off to the side to be doing. So it's a little bit crazy.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
It's art. Art is crazy. And I agree. Personally, I find it difficult sometimes to create anything because it does take a lot of time and it feels sometimes like you're being really selfish. Like, I'm doing this thing, it has no apparent useful purpose, at least not until someone buys it or, you know, something good comes of it, and yet I'm doing it. And people who know me will attest that few things irritate me more than people who are selfish, and I hate that about if I'm ever doing something that I think is selfish. So isolating myself, as much as I wish I could go to work and do that, it is hard. It is one of those struggles in being any sort of artist, creating anything, that we don't tend to think about. It's just kind of this internal struggle, and that's why we all wear black and we're all tortured, even though none of us are wearing black today. Military history, we're going to come back to that because the music that you heard at the top of the show, that was Sabaton. I'm just going to let you tell us about that.
Yeah, the Sabaton. That's hard to explain because it's like, oh, it just sounds like something that some high school kid would be listening to wearing, you know, one of those, well, my generation, like an old Guns N' Roses or Metallica shirt.
I'm going to interject here long enough to say that Sabaton is from Sweden, and they do heavy metal that's based on military history. So the song you heard at the top of the show is in Swedish, if you were trying to figure out what language that was. They do a lot of songs with lyrics in English. So, John, you're going to tell us why you dig their music and what it does for you.
I like it because, number one, I can understand the words. And believe it or not, that's a real problem for me. If I'm listening to, there's a lot of music, I can't understand what they're saying. Or it takes me so many listens to figure out what they're saying. And then when I do find out what they're saying, it turns out to not be worth the effort. That bothers me. And also, their song choices are interesting because it's often about, you know, some event or battle or something that happened in the past that they're telling a story about that then makes me curious. Like, what is this about? Some of their popular songs, they do a song about D-Day called Primo Victoria. They did another song about an incident where there was a B-17 flying along and had been damaged after an air raid over Germany in World War II. And a German fighter came up, and instead of shooting it down, the pilot saw that everybody was wounded and the plane was falling apart, and he just let them go. He just, not only that, he escorted them through the anti-aircraft and let them go and said bye. Didn't shoot them down. And so there's these interesting stories they tell about things that happened in the past. It's nice because it's not this dark and depressing music. It's not about sex in the club and going to the club and teenager stuff. And it's about a subject that doesn't come up in music very often.
That is true. And when I first listened to it, when you told me about it, my word was epic.
Yes, it's very epic.
How very Scandinavian. They're very good at epics.
And it's very good for filling space in my head when I'm trying to write or block out, you know, what's going on around me so that I can think. Because it's, well, I there's a lot of things going on. A lot of what I like in music is I like patterns and I like precision. You know, like Frank Zappa is great. There's another group. Weird Al is amazing. You know, besides being funny, he's an amazing musician. Like, he hits everything. Like, when he does a parody of a song, very often he plays it better than the original artist. You know, and so I like the precision. Also, you know, it's just kind of noisy and blocks things out.
I would give it that. Yeah. I admit I have a hard time listening to it and doing anything else.
Right.
It pretty much demands attention, whether you're going to give it to it or not. So, do you listen to this while you're writing?
Yeah, I do.
And it works?
It works great.
I can't imagine that. So there's several different reasons why John is here on the podcast today. One of them is, of course, we met on the submarine, and we're both tour guides, and we both apparently like submarines. And the other is that we both deal with sight issues, which affects us in different ways because we have different conditions going on. I'm not going to belabor the point about me because you have to listen to me all the time. So, John, I'm going to ask you a little bit about what your world looks like and how it affects, you think, particularly your creativity. Do you look at a story in a different way? Do you approach telling a story, maybe focusing on other senses?
I can't see very well. Even I've got, without my glasses, I've got about 2400 vision. So, like, without them, I look around and everything's just kind of a blur. Like, I can't even, I can see the microphone in front of me. You're a blur.
I feel that way every morning when I get up.
With correction, I can still see, like, well enough to drive. But my vision is getting progressively worse. My mom has macular degeneration, so I don't know if that'll ever happen to me, but it's certainly a possibility. Also, I had a lazy eye in childhood that was corrected with surgery. But that left its own issues, like if I get tired at all, and even sometimes when I'm not, I'll start seeing double.
That's good if you're counting money, but otherwise, you know, money that someone's giving you, if you see two of it, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no, not so much. I like what you said when we were discussing the outline for this. You said you have more floaters than a sewage plant.
Oh, yeah.
I totally dig that. I don't see that in my particular strange sight view, but I just love the imagery.
Oh, yeah. There's just floaters everywhere. I can mostly ignore them, but occasionally it's really a problem. Like, now I notice them. Now I'm paying attention. But against a bright background, there's just all these floaters everywhere. I don't know whether that's a legacy of that eye surgery or not, or whether it's just my eye strain or what. But there's all these just things floating around in my field of view all the time. There's really nothing to be done about it.
It's just trippy. You just got to enjoy it, you know, relax and go, wow. And people look at you and go, why is he staring off into space that way?
Yeah, I
do that a lot. People don't tell me. I'm sure I do, though. Mm-hmm. They don't tell me about it as often as they probably should. So how does that affect your writing, or does it?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons I write so much is there's a lot of people that are fairly well-centered in what's going on around them and the world that they're in, and they pay attention to what's happening around them. I'm not one of those people. I'm always in my head thinking about stuff. So I'm a very poor Zen Buddhist. You know, I'm not in the moment at all. I think part of that is just it's like, oh, well, people are always telling me to look at stuff or see stuff, and I just haven't noticed it. And a lot of that is because I can't, because I just didn't see it. You know, I don't. In addition to, you know, having a hard time seeing things, I just don't notice things. You know, like I can even be looking for something and I can't see it. Something's going on neurologically. Like I was walking down the ramp, and I was pretty sure you were down here. Didn't see you. I was looking for you. And then right when I got near the bottom, I'm like, oh, there you are. And you'd been there the whole time. It's just it didn't process that you were there.
Right.
So that was...
And I was not doing the right thing. I wasn't making any noise. If I'd been making noise, you probably would have known I was there.
I would have known you were there immediately.
Yes, I say that to people all the time. Well, why didn't you wave at me? Did you make a sound? Then I don't know you're there.
Yeah.
It is a quote that has been overused to the point where I even hate to mention it, but there is an addition that I've put on that I think is important. Helen Keller said, when you're blind, you lose touch with things. When you're deaf, you lose touch with people. And I agree with that, but it's said too often, and what people don't understand in today's world with our absolute dependence on technology is that in order to talk to people, you have to use a thing. And so when you lose touch with things, you now by definition are losing touch with people. And that's part of why this podcast exists, is to talk to people, not necessarily with disabilities, but just to you know, have conversations and get people thinking and hopefully communicating, talking to one another, writing comments, suggesting topics, maybe even, God forbid, make a donation to help keep this podcast going strong. You like how I put that plug in there?
I like it.
If you can articulate for us, go back to Sabaton. And this is this huge epic. Phil Spector would love these guys because it is absolutely the wall of sound.
Yes.
How does it work for you? Can you explain that?
There's all these different things going on that you can look at. There's a pattern. There's like the bassline pattern. There's the vocal pattern. Sometimes you've got rhythm guitar. And also you have whatever the lead guitar is doing. And you can always just switch and lock on any particular one of these things and listen to it. And I like finding patterns inside of something else. That's one of the things that I do. And so I can go, I never picked up on that pattern, what the rhythm guitar is doing during this song. And then you can listen to what the melody of the song is, or you can listen to the vocals and separate them out. And that's kind of one of the things that I can do. Like listening to Bach is incredible because there's all this different stuff going on. You know, it's like one pattern on another pattern and another pattern. It's just really, really interesting to me.
I won't say it's busy music because it's not, but it is very complex. It does have a lot of layers. And as a musician, one of the things you learn pretty quickly after you start to play an instrument, especially if you play with other people, like in a band, you learn to listen for whatever it is you need to listen for. If you're learning a song, you're going to listen for the instrument that you play. If you are playing in the band and you need to cue off of the rhythm guitarist and you're the bass player, you're going to listen for the rhythm guitar. Your ears can be very selective about that. It sounds safe to say you're kind of a pattern recognition nerd.
Oh yeah, I'm so good at pattern recognition that I see patterns when there aren't any. It's not too bad, because then you get into like mental illness. But yeah, I'm very good at taking a whole bunch of information and condensing it down into something.
I have to tell you, now I know you've heard an advanced copy of episode 1 with my interview with DM Elms and her book Sidelings. And I've got to encourage you to go for the decoder ring, because it's patterns within patterns, and you would probably totally get off on that. So my question then, going back to New Persia, have you hidden any patterns in there? You don't have to tell us what they are.
Oh, a few. I mean, for one thing, I don't name the Baha'i religion. I just give a bunch of facts about it and stuff the characters do. And, you know, like there's a 9-pointed star on the flag. So if you know anything at all about it, you'll recognize it. I've always kind of liked that with writers, when they give little hints, but they don't tell you. And it isn't like super hidden or anything. We're talking about it, but it's there.
Any complex math? Any,
no.
Any, you know, words in the title that come back later, or certain syllables or letters or anything, any, you know, heavy-duty pattern recognition like that?
There's a lot of setups and payoffs. Stuff will happen. Most of the things that happen in the book matter later. I tried to make it that way. So if there's a character that's introduced, they matter. You know, if some idea comes up, it matters. You know, Chekhov's gun. If there's a gun on the wall in the first act, it better have been taken off the wall by the third act. I don't want to say that, I know, dropping hints and patterns and stuff is messing with the readers, but I don't, you know, this is light reading.
So it's sit down, read it, enjoy it. If you find things there, you find these, you know, deep-seated patterns, they're probably your own, is that?
Yeah, they're probably mine.
No, I mean the readers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Yes.
Yeah, so you don't have a secret decoder ring that people can go for.
I don't.
Okay, sorry campers, you're going to have to go back and reread Sidelings and
see
if you can get it all in there. So I am curious, because you mentioned Uncle Frank, do you have a favorite Frank Zappa song?
It's escaping me. The name of the song.
It's okay. We are going to take a quick break and insert a little something from Uncle Frank, maybe even John's favorite song if we can figure out what it is, and we will be right back.
I'm
So there was some Frank Zappa because John and I both like Frank Zappa. If you do, awesome, you got some Frank today. If not, well, maybe you'll be a fan now. So you're working on book two.
Yes.
Don't spoil it, but where do we go from here?
Book one is an intro to the characters in the world, mostly. The war starts between a Zany and New Persia. Book two is called The Tempest. And it's called The Tempest because it's a giant storm. Everything is going wrong for the New Persians. The Azanians are better and more power. They're better militarily. They have a smaller army, but it beats the larger New Persian forces all the time. They're having a lot of trouble stopping them. The only thing they have going for them is New Persia, like Russia, is big. But the Azanians are still coming, and they're coming for the capital. Also, a revolution has broken out in the capital. Like, if you've ever heard or read about the French Commune, something like that happens. And one of the characters introduced in the first book ends up leading it. And she's the disgraced daughter of a treasonous general to becoming the head of this revolution based on her own gifts and charisma and ability. So there's the capital city is revolted. And there's a strange situation in that the government wants to put the rebellion down, the government of New Persia, but they can't because they don't have the force to do it because they're at war with the Azanians. And the commune in the capital doesn't want the Azanians to win either, but they know that even that there's eventually going to be a reckoning with the government. And so in the middle of this, there's battles, there's my pilot character flies around, there's a submarine, believe it or not.
I totally believe that.
Yeah, I've written the submarine parts. For some reason, they're much more detailed than other parts of the book.
I can't imagine why that would be. In at least the first book, and probably in book two also, you've worked really hard on women's roles.
Yeah.
In this world, and sort of there's a lot of struggle. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Something that bugged me from a young age was demography in science fiction. You have these worlds like Star Trek, in Star Wars and all these places where you have these giant galactic empires that are full of people, and yet everybody has like two kids, or maybe one, or none. And it's not possible. The type of society you need to populate new planets is going to look a lot like an American frontier family back in the early 19th century where you have like 10 kids. You know, the women don't do a whole lot other than, you know, laundry and cleaning house and having children and raising children, and that's all they have time to do. So when I'm looking at, you know, stories about colonizing other planets, I'm like, well, how are you going to do that if you're not having a lot of children? And so far in our own history, having a lot of children means a certain role for women, and there's going to be societal expectations and norms and rules and even laws that enforce that. And it's not comfortable to talk about that. And I was really like, man, this is kind of appalling, in that the state of human biology dictates certain roles for women if we're going to be colonizing other planets. My characters kind of struggle with that. One in particular, she's kind of getting to an age where she has to get married, and she doesn't want to. And the way she frames it is like, well, I haven't met anybody I want to marry, but really she's just doesn't want to get married. She wants to go have her own life. She wants her own career. She wants her own education, you know, and she wants a role for herself that doesn't exist in this culture that has been shaped by its environment, by these seed storms that come every so often, by the fact that they're on an alien world and need people to do anything. And it's interesting, and although she defies expectations and does her own thing and she finds a way to do it, it's also kind of tragic that this world, just by its nature, has a role for women that isn't what we're used to or working towards, you know, where we are now. So that was the thinking that went into it.
So you are autism spectrum, is that right?
Yeah.
And do you feel that that's a help or a hindrance as a writer?
Oh, boy.
Or probably, I should both. Say both, yeah.
Where it's helpful is the ability to master details and get them into the writing, and having a memory good enough to get details in, because I can pull things from stuff I read 30 years ago and recall it and go, oh yeah, I remember that. Where it's a problem is just kind of the way it's a problem with everything else is you miss your social cues, so you need to be really careful writing that in, like, because your characters are supposed to be like real people. They're not supposed to be like autism spectrum people. Okay. Not that autism spectrum people aren't real, but you can't have an entire book populated with them unless that's what you're intentionally writing. So you have to be able to write neurotypical people. And that's why it's good to read a lot and at least get the idea of what fictional people act like. My own thing with autism in my own life is I've kind of treated it as like, this is something I need to overcome. And the degree to which I've overcome it is the degree to which I've been more successful. I treat it as a disability most of the time. I mean, I do get some pretty cool things like an amazing memory. I get the ability to see patterns and condense stuff down. But I get so many problems. You know, just from like not being able to see stuff that's right in front of me to completely bungling social interactions without meaning to. I don't have this so much. I used to have sensory issues when I was younger. I don't miss that. So the degree to which I've been like, okay, acting like this isn't helpful. How can I act differently in the future? And then how can I get myself to do that so that I'll not only be happier, but I'll be better for everyone else around me.
You look at it as, you said, something to be overcome. Is that different than adapting?
The way I look at it, I think it is. It's not a cuddly disability that nobody's going to generally think more of you for being autism spectrum, is what I've discovered.
I have not met anybody who thinks more of someone for having a disability.
Right.
I kind of see where you're going, though. It's they're not going to look at you and say, wow, that John guy, he's so courageous.
Right. It's not a positive,
it's not one
cuddly.
Of the, yeah, it's yeah. Not one of the big, you know, telethon type poster child, look at this person overcoming adversity and they have such courage and character and Because I get that. Blindness is one of those disabilities that people are like, oh, you can do these things, and how amazing, you're a profile in courage, and we're going to send your story to Reader's Digest. And that's really nice that people think that.
Yeah.
But...
And, like, fictional autism spectrum people, particularly on TV, it's like, yeah, you have some really nice, good-looking person, and you don't ever portray the stuff that isn't funny. And there's funny autism stuff that happens. Like, I watched this Netflix series called Atypical. And it's pretty funny for what it is, but as far as being realistic, not really, not at all. You know, because you, in your autism spectrum, you're kind of strange, and you're off-putting. And you have to work really hard to overcome that, because just naturally you're going to... I used to call it my repulsion field, because I could walk into a crowd of people that had never seen me before, or I could go sit down at a table and no one would go near me. Just whatever vibe I was putting out.
I have that. It's called a white cane.
Yeah.
You walk down the mall with your white cane and you feel like Moses parting the Red Sea. It is an awesome feeling. I'm going to be honest about that.
Yeah.
But yes, it is a repulsor field. Blindness is one of those invisible disabilities. If you're not carrying a prop, like a white cane or a guide dog, and you're not running into walls, people don't know.
Yeah.
Is it because autism spectrum carries some behavioral cues, then I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. Is it even the way you hold yourself or the way you look around a room?
Yeah.
People notice that, even if they don't realize that they're noticing it.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about my tour guide role is I seem to be really good at it. You know, not to brag, but it's
No, he can brag. He's good at it. I've done tours with him, and he's good.
Yeah, and it just seems like when I'm in that role, and I'm fine. But if I were, you know, to run into a random group of people doing something else, they'd be like, who's this weird guy? It's just this thing that trying to overcome those whatever weird cues I send out so that they're not a problem. You know, back in my 20s when I was like trying to date, it was amazing just how bad I was at it. You know, because it's all nonverbal, you know, and social cues, and that's what dating is. You know, and you know, where I've had success is with you know, like women who actually really knew me really well. All the women I've known really well, I've been married two of them.
Not at the same time,
though. Not at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were both really, you know, my ex-wife's a really nice lady. My current wife is, I worship her. She's amazing.
She'll like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Best thing that ever happened to me. But, yeah, it's this weird thing. And people are aware of it now, but it's still, you know, when you meet actual autism spectrum people, it doesn't, people are not like excited by it. They're not like, wow, this is so cool. It's just like, okay. Like, I don't know if you're here when they had all the intellectually disabled people. They had a couple groups of them on the boat.
I was not here that day.
Yeah. And I just walked into a tour and it was like, oh, it's a bunch of, it's 16 ID people. And I'm like, and you know what? It was the best tour. I loved it. I could totally just get them.
So they were your tribe.
Yeah, they kind of were.
They were on board. It's like, my people's here.
Yeah. And they were just wonderful. And they asked really good questions. Like one of them was like, well, why would you need... We were in the torpedo room talking about, why would you need to fight other people? Why would you want to sink someone's ship? And I'm like, boy, that's a good question. Why? You know, and
your tour stalls there for an hour while you debate military philosophy.
You know, why do people go to war? It's great. And, like, some of them would talk, and they had kind of this, I don't want to say, I'll just say it was really hammered speech. Where it'd be like, and I could understand them a lot of the time. And I'd be like, okay. And I would just talk back. And it made sense to me. So there was something in my brain that was picking up on it. And it was really definitely the highlight of my day having that tour. It was really, really cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
And it is a positive thing when you do connect. I mean, that's what this podcast is about.
Yeah.
The whole series is about things that connect people. But whether you connect with your tribe you know, you have something genuinely in common, and you can take advantage of that in a positive way, or you do just happen to connect with a different person. You're like, oh, I have this thing about me that allows me to, you know, do this. I can understand someone better.
Mm-hmm.
In that vein, have you considered putting an autism spectrum character in one of your books, or just writing even nonfiction about your world?
Yeah, this is what my wife says I should be writing about. I actually think, you know, one of the points of literature and writing is so that you can understand people who are different than you, so that you can contact your shared humanity. Writing an autism spectrum character, I could do that. Maybe that would help. That's not a terrible idea. Writing about my own life, I'm like, my own life's been kind of crazy, and doing anything autobiographical I could do, it would probably be written in a humorous vein, you know, because I think a lot of it's turned out pretty well in the end, so I could do that.
Well, and it's important, I find, to use humor effectively.
Yeah,
if you can. I mean, I'm the first one to tell a blind joke. And people, you know, it's interesting the reactions you get. Some people laugh immediately, and some people are like, oh, that's in such poor taste. It's like, look, if you can't hit your own gang, who can you hit?
Yeah.
But for me, what's really important is it helps set people at ease because they don't know what to do. They don't want to say the wrong word. They don't want to do whatever it is they're not supposed to do. They're, you know, terrified of doing something wrong,
right,
whatever it is. And so if I can show them I'm at ease with myself, this is what I've got going on, and it doesn't, you know, I'm not brooding, I'm not fragile, I just don't see things.
Yeah.
I think that goes a long way to acceptance, and I think not just about disability, any part of a society. Because we've spent a lot of time in the last 15 to 20 years, a lot of different groups are seeking acceptance, but they're doing it a lot of times in a way that's almost aggressive. It's not really the most accurate word, but what we're not doing is we're not communicating. We're not laughing at ourselves and saying, you know, what we're doing is important. No one's trying to devalue it, but there are things that are funny.
Yes.
And so it's important to... I've been known on rare occasions to pull a Mr. Magoo line on somebody, and they're like, how can you do that? And say, hey, if I can't laugh at me, then I'm way too serious. That's part of what brings us together. Humans do goofy things.
Yes, they do.
Sometimes on purpose and sometimes not.
Yeah. And I'll be about the last person who's going to get offended about, you know, anything anybody says about autism spectrum. Or like, I call my friends. I have a bunch of internet friends. And then one day, I was like, hey, because I'd done a bunch of research and gotten myself diagnosed, because I was researching into what was going on with one of my kids. And I was like, well, I don't know if this fits my kid, but man, it sure fits me. And I went and took some tests, and I was like, oh. I'm like, hey, everybody. Got on the internet. Hey, I'm autism spectrum. And they're like, oh. Oh, yeah, so am I. And then they're like, so am I. And I'm like, oh, don't tell me all my internet friends are autism spectrum. I'm like, why didn't you guys say something? What? Why didn't you guys... Never mind. You know, and yeah, so it was really funny. So I call them the Spurgs. These are my internet Spurg friends, after Asperger's.
Ah, okay.
Which I guess could be construed as a, well, what do you call it, disparaging term.
Possibly.
But I don't...
We'll have to check the
care.
We'll have to check the Urban Dictionary.
Yes,
and
Spurgs.
See if that has some other meaning that we don't know about. I'm sure there must be something in Rule 34 about it.
Yeah, no.
We're trying not to go there. You have an excerpt from Book 1, is that right?
I do.
It's not a film clip, obviously, because you couldn't see it on a podcast, but right. Set up your film clip for us.
Well, what this is it's a flashback. Back to when two of the main characters, Basir and Farad, were children. And they were playing ball, and they found something.
And we're going to find out, probably, hopefully not what that something is, because we wouldn't want to give it away. You got to read the book. But we're going to find out about their journey of discovery, short though it may be. So here is an excerpt from New Persia Before the Storm.
Basir and Farad played outside near the irrigation canal on Basir's father's orchard. Both suns were up, the true sun casting a noontime orange glow over the carefully kept green rows of pistachio trees. The second sun, Shaitan, was halfway up in the sky, a bright light too intense to stare at. The shadows of Shaitan were lost in the glare of the first sun. The trees had not yet shed their nuts. When they did, the floor of the orchard would become a red carpet of shells ready to be harvested. The ground was dry and hard. Little water had fallen from the sky or come down the slopes of the Zagros Mountains in the form of melted snow. The boys played their kickball game between the rows of trees. Farad was quicker and could trick Basir away from the ball. He played to score. Basir was thoughtful and patient. He waited for opportunities and played to keep Farad from scoring. Farad often accused him of trying to win by boring his opponent into quitting. Farad passed the leather ball between his feet as Basir watched for an opening. Farad grinned and shifted his weight to one side. Basir seemed to fall for the bait. Quick as a fox, Farad switched feet and shot the ball past Basir on one side and sprinted to the other. Basir was not caught wholly unawares. He did something that he knew would hurt, but it was the only way to stop Farad from scoring. He spun in place and put himself on the path of his charging friend. The boys crashed together and fell in a heap in the dusty soil. Each struggled to stand while trying to keep the other down. Farad's bulk helped get him to his feet first, but Basir tripped him on the first step and he fell again. Basir rose cat-like and sprung past Farad, but was caught by the ankle in Farad's powerful grasp. The ball rolled towards the irrigation canal. Farad yanked hard and brought Basir down beside him. He pushed his other hand into the smaller boy's back and jumped over Basir's arm before he could grab Farad's errant leg. In a second, Farad was off after the ball. Basir jumped after him, but it was too late. Farad would win a sprint, and it wasn't far enough for Basir's small frame to win an endurance race. Farad almost caught the ball before it went over the edge. Cursing, he ran to the edge of the ditch as the ball slid down the muddy bank and landed in the stinking dregs at the bottom. "You let it fall in," he called to Basir, who had just arrived to stare down at the mass of stinking decay in the ditch. "I didn't touch it," Basir said. "That was your kick, and it's out of bounds." Basir smiled. Frustrated, Farad knew that his friend was right, but he didn't like it. Then he remembered. "But if I kicked it out of bounds, it's your ball." He smiled. Basir's face fell. It was true. He would have to get the ball and pass it back into play. "There's something wrong here," he said. "It doesn't seem fair." "It's your ball," Farad mocked. "What's unfair about it?" Sighing, Basir bowed to the inevitable and removed his shoes. His father would never forgive him for running them in the muck. He slid down the side of the ditch and felt the awful paste of gooey waste clinging to his calves. He carefully shuffled forward, feeling with his toes for anything sharp and dangerous buried in the mud. His footsteps disturbed the muck and released a bubble of stench that rose up to Farad's nose. "That's horrible," Farad said. "You're up there," Basir shot back. He was a few feet from the scum-covered ball when his left foot touched something hard. Basir recoiled and jerked back his foot. He moved a few inches to the side and walked forward again. His foot found the object. It was hard and smooth. Basir's curiosity rose. Many things fell into ditches, and he wondered if it was perhaps an old engine part or even an ancient device, the kind that could no longer be made. He hesitated briefly before surrendering his hands to the muck. He felt around until he found the smooth outline in his hands. He strained his arms and back and forgot the clinging mud for his prize. It came out with a splash that spattered Basir with mud all over his body. His clothes would be ruined. His father would be incensed. Farad, knowing Basir's father, winced from the bank. "Why did you do that?" Basir ignored him, accepting that punishment was inevitable now, and he may as well satisfy the curiosity that had brought him the stench-covered treasure he held in his hands. He shook it and brushed off the largest chunks of mud. The surface was smooth and dark. It was larger than the ball that sat forgotten a few feet away. It wasn't round, but oblong, and had a seam running down its length. "Look," Basir said, holding the object above his head. "What is it?" Farad asked. "I don't know," Basir said. "Bring it here." Ha, Basir said, you should come down here. Farad frowned, and Basir enjoyed the moment of pettiness before he trudged to the edge and handed the object up to his friend. Don't get your hands dirty, Basir taunted. Farad scoffed at the challenge and took the object into both hands. He turned it over, examining it, while Basir clambered out, covering the wet muck with the dry dust of the orchard. It must be native life, Basir said. Why? Farad said. It feels hard as metal. But not heavy, Basir said. Feel how light it is. Farad tossed it lightly in the air. Could it be an ancient device? Farad asked. Native life, though rare in this long-settled region of the North Province, was not something to go crawling into a ditch for. It was something to be pulled out of the ground wherever it showed itself. I don't know any native plants this big. We don't let them get this big, Basir said. It must be from the north. Perhaps it was washed down the ditch in the rainstorm. There had been a massive flash flood the week before. It had come and gone so quickly that the ground had soaked up the moisture in an hour. Huh, Farad said, rotating the object in his hands. You're probably right. We should look inside, though. Inside? Basir asked. Yes, Farad said. See the seam here? I think we should open it.
So that was John Lynch reading an excerpt from his first book in a series, in the New Persia series called New Persia Before the Storm. John has a website that's under construction. You can find a link to that website in the notes for this very episode. John, it has been a blast having you here and being on the submarine. Thank you for joining us.
It's been great. Thanks.
So once again, we are coming to you from the USS Blueback here at OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. Thanks very much to the museum and Bill Diltz, our department head guy, for saying yes to this podcast.
Thank you, Bill.
As we mentioned before, the sub is open. Every day the museum is open and tours are available. Guided tours given by people like John and myself and several other people who are a little closer to normal than we are. That wraps it up for this episode of the Acoustic Pedestrian Podcast. Thanks very much to my guest, John Lynch, for joining us on the submarine today. Thanks also to patrons Laura and Bill, and all fans that are about to be. If you would like to support this podcast, you totally can do that. Go to theacousticpedestrian.com. You can find links to a one-time donation, or better still, you can become a patron on Patreon, and your pledge of a dollar or more will help keep this podcast running smoothly and hopefully more often. So long for now from the USS Blueback. Remember until next time to walk gently and keep listening.